Hello again. This is The Thing About Cars coming at you live from another wintry day in Atlanta. Is it winter, you guys? Is it, or is it still fall?
I don't know about that. It's pretty warm. It's 64 degrees to be winter.
Yeah, it's supposed to get a high of 68 today, so who knows?
It's not to the solstice yet, so we haven't officially made it to winter.
Right, so we're not officially in winter. That's right. Okay, so around the table, we have, obviously, Dawn. Hello, Dawn.
Hello.
And Amanda.
Hello.
Amanda's joining us by phone today, so hopefully everybody can hear her all right. And then last but certainly not least is Ben.
Hey, hey.
He's the other guy in this episode of Two Girls and Two Guys in the backseat. Are we in the backseat again?
You are, because Amanda's driving.
I think that's perfect, yes.
I think it's...
As long as... Mine.
I think it's cool that Amanda's phoning it in from the road.
I'm in the back seat with Mickey. Aren't I lucky?
Stop kicking my seat.
Ben's touching me.
If I have to turn around one more time.
Don't make me pull this podcast over and separate you.
That's good. All right, so let's do our quick moment of Grand Trivia Auto. I actually have a couple things to share. One of is not really a question as much as it is just this bit of information I found. And I'm wondering if this is true. Hopefully you guys can help me figure out if this is true. The statement says that the English drive on the left because everyone drove on the left back in the day. When knights passed in armor, they shook hands as a sign of detente. Like, I have your weapon hand, you have my weapon hand. And most people are right-handed, so they passed on the left on horseback so they didn't have to reach across their armor to shake hands. Now, when Napoleon took over countries, one of his first acts was to make people pass on the right. There were no more knights by that time, and by passing on the right, with every social interaction, you were acknowledging now that, quote, Napoleon rules this part of the world, end quote. So he never got to England, and that's why England continues to drive on the left. Is this true?
Man, it sounds logical.
I'd call it plausible.
It's plausible. Whether it's the causation is there, I'm not sure. But wow, yeah. Interesting.
So hopefully there's some
history. I'm not that old, so I can't say for certain.
Ben, you look like you got the thought.
What I was thinking was that, that's certainly plausible. The whole debate about which side of the car the driver is on is more complex. Including the early cars in the United States where we were driving on the right side of the road and the right side of the car and all the origins of that.
Right.
Yeah, I was thinking about that the other day. Like, why do we drive near the center of the flow of traffic instead of away?
Being near the center of the road improves the driver's visibility in all directions. But, you can see more if you're near the middle of the road.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's true.
Whereas in the early days, being on the same side as the curb was more convenient just because, streets were often unpaved and full of horse crap and garbage.
Mm-hmm. And horses. And dead horses. A lot of people don't know that horse crap and dead horses was a huge problem once upon a time.
So I'm curious, has anybody driven in a country on the left?
Yes, I've been to India.
Did you drive?
I did not drive. I wanted to, but I think it would have been very bad if I had done it.
I've been to Caymans and I did not drive, but it literally freaked me out.
Well, I think if you're going to do the left-hand driving thing, India, I don't know about Caymans, but India is probably not the place to try it. There are literally only two rules of traffic in India, and they are stay as far to the left as possible and don't have any accidents. And that's it.
Yeah, my brother did it in Australia for 2 or 3 weeks, and he had very little trouble adjusting, but he was largely in, pretty rural areas.
Right. So I hope our history buffs out there can help us verify the claim that English, the English drive on the left because Napoleon never made it there. But our official trivia, my official Grand Trivia Auto question for the day is, what was the biggest actual speeding ticket ever given in terms of adjusted U.S. dollars? Wow. Was the biggest speeding ticket fine ever given, was it $217,000? Was it $290,000? Or was it $1 million? And then the last choice is, was it $2,400,000? One of those is the correct answer.
Is this like conversion from other countries' numbers, or?
Yes, these are valued in U.S. dollars.
Interesting.
Yeah. So we'll come back to that.
They all sound horrific.
Yeah, they all sound completely horrific, but we'll come back to that at the end of the show. Let's switch gears now and take it to Amanda, who's going to do a segment of Relationship Roadster for us. Amanda, what have you got on your mind today?
So I have ambulances on the mind.
Oh. You used to drive one, right?
I did indeed. I've driven a lot of ambulances. Oh. And it's funny when you look back at all of the different types of ambulances and models and like modern ambulances. But when you look back at the history, because, you know, paramedics have only been around for not 40 or 50 yeah. years, you know, they're yeah. not, they've not been around a long time. So before paramedics and before ambulances, the hospitals employed hearses, which, you know, it's kind of convenient. You dial away or they just take you to a different destination, I guess. But basically, they were station wagons that they started out with, you know, and they went from there to vans. And then from vans, they went to bigger trucks and bigger trucks and bigger trucks. And
yeah.
I have driven some pretty big ambulances, but they're also very specifically specialized. You know, nowadays you could pretty much do pretty much anything short of cooking lunch in an ambulance, which sounds a little bit like an exaggeration, but I mean, you probably could plug up a microwave and run it, because like the last ambulance I worked, that I drove working for the Children's Hospital, we had a generator and an inverter, so we could run pretty much anything electric, and we had a million power outlets and equipment outlets and everything else. So we probably could have plugged up a microwave, and I've actually seen pictures recently of an ambulance that was retrofitted as an RV. You know, that's very popular nowadays, but it had a shower and a bathtub, or not a bathtub, a shower and a toilet and stove and sink and all of that in it. So it's really interesting when you look back at all of the different, what would the word be?
Iterations, evolutions?
Definitely the iterations for sure, but all the different progressions that you could have in terms of equipment, because, you know, the first ambulances,
Amanda, we lost you. Let's bring Amanda back. It's like bringing sexy back, but different.
Lordy.
Yeah, Amanda, you have to, there you are again.
Yeah. Can you hear me again?
Yeah, you must have gone through a pocket or something. Hit it again.
I don't know what happened. That's kind of weird.
Let's take it from iterations to watching ambulances evolve and go through iterations.
And different evolutions of the equipment that they carried. The first ambulances started out as vehicles to just transport a patient from point A to point B. And then they went on to become a vehicle that transported a patient from point A to point B and could carry some equipment along. And they've gotten to where just short of you could do surgery inside.
Yeah. Well, and not Grady, not to draw too much of a direct comparison, or maybe it's worth drawing a direct comparison. I have a friend who's a mobile vet, and she absolutely does minor surgeries in her vet truck.
I can believe it. Grady Hospital downtown has an ambulance that's just specifically for stroke patients, and they can do CT scans in the ambulance.
Wow.
They have a CT scanner in the ambulance that is, because the first thing you have to do is verify that a patient doesn't have any bleeding in the brain, so you can give them blood medicines to break up the clot that causes a stroke. So you want to make sure that they're not already bleeding. So you do a quick CT scan, and then they can start medications in the ambulance. And they've had, you know, huge outcomes with that.
You know, it's so funny, Amanda. I always tell people, if someone has a stroke or heart attack, send them to Grady. Grady first. You know, if you can get into Grady, it's amazing. And I didn't know about the ambulance, but that is probably why their success rate is so high.
Well, they're
definitely a focus for them.
Yeah. I mean, you know,
what were you going to say, Nikki?
I was going to say, if you have a choice, there are some people who say that Grady's trauma capabilities leave them in a better position to treat some things. But in the end, I'm not sure it matters. Like if I were still in McDonough, you know, I'm not sure I would tell an ambulance driver to take me to Grady.
If you were able to tell the person driving the ambulance to take you to Grady,
yes,
you probably would not be in a situation where you would need Grady.
Yeah, isn't that the irony of it? So I'm curious, Amanda. Lately, I've been reading a lot of articles that, unfortunately, they have COVID patients lined up in ambulances around the country, yes, waiting to get a bed in a hospital. And so, yep. I mean, I've read where some ambulances are now equipped for at least that one person to be in the cab so that they are not exposed to COVID from the patient in the back. Is there a lot of infectious protocol in ambulances?
There is to some degree, but really with a lot of 911 calls, you know that, or you recognize that, you know, going out to someone's house, you have no idea what their medical problems are. You know, for all you know, they have the flu or the COVID or whatever else. You know, you just kind of have to follow some pretty standard sets of precautions to minimize your exposure to whatever, especially nowadays.
Right. So talking about the evolution from hearses to an actual dedicated vehicle just for transporting the wounded, I wonder if wartime had anything to do with helping that progression along, or was it after
World War II? Yes, it did.
Yeah.
I've been sitting on this thought for several minutes now. The first ones were actually two men in a stretcher, and this is where the term ambulance begins being used, because it comes from the Latin ambulo, which means to walk. So it was basically something that allowed someone who couldn't walk to get up and get off the battlefield.
Yes,
right, and they would put that stretcher on the back of a Jeep, right?
Well, they didn't have Jeeps in the Civil War.
Oh, I was thinking World War II. Yeah.
Oh, even before.
Yeah.
Horse and carriage, basically.
It goes back before motor vehicles. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess that's true. So I've always wanted a recent era, not recent, I should say, but I always wanted one of those stereotypical white station wagon hearse looking ambulances. You know, it looks white. It's got one dome light on the roof. And, you know, it's the kind of thing that you would convert. Exactly. The Ghostbusters vehicle. I don't know that I want the Ghostbusters vehicle, although that would be cool. But just a retro ambulance, I think, would be fun to play with.
A different one. Yeah, a different one would set you back a lot less money. The Ghostbusters car was, I believe, a Miller Meteor.
Yeah.
And since the making of the film, those have become, you know, the number one sought after model of old Cadillac hearse/ambulance. And so, yeah, if you can find one, the prices are very high.
Yeah. Yeah.
Especially if you can find one that someone hasn't already converted into an Ecto-1. Because right. a lot of those get built as well.
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, if money were no object, it would be fun to have an Ecto-1 in the garage, but we were talking some time ago about doing a cornball run or whatever it was called, where you spend less than $1,000 on a car and then you have to race essentially across several states from point A to point B, and hopefully your car makes it, right? And I found at that time, this was back in probably 2001, 2002, I found a 50s or 60s era Cadillac hearse that had a 500 cubic inch engine in it. And I so desperately wanted to get that, and I just didn't do it at the time. but just massive engine in there. I'm like, oh God, you know, displacement heaven. But
displacement again.
Yes, exactly.
The initial purchase may have been cheap, but that'd be the only part of it that would be.
Right.
Definitely. The maintenance would be a little bit difficult.
What you'll pay for fuel too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, something that big and heavy with a 500 in it, you know, you're going to be measuring in gallons per mile.
Right.
Definitely.
It's a dollar per stroke of the engine.
Just about.
Yeah. So thanks, Amanda. What else do we have to say about ambulances?
I think that covered it pretty well.
Get out of the way when there's one coming.
Yes,
definitely.
If we were doing Grind My Gear, that's the one thing that makes me so mad. It was when, as soon as you hear an ambulance, pull over, get over, move over, people move over. I mean, you can be you in that ambulance someday.
Exactly.
So it's just,
people don't know courtesy and they don't know the protocol.
It just, that really grinds my gears when people do not pull over when an ambulance siren or a police siren or, you know, another type of emergency vehicle, like a fire engine. It's like, why do you,
let's put that on the list, Don. Let's put that on the list for a full blown grind my gears segment.
Oh, let's do it.
And you'll have to introduce that one and then we can all just pile on.
Sounds great.
So thank you. Thanks, Amanda.
Absolutely.
And let's go to switch gears now to Dawn. Dawn's going to drive us through the decades again. This time the 80s, right, Dawn?
Yes, I'm feeling very nostalgic for the time I spent in high school and college was the entire span of the 80s. And, you know, it's interesting. There wasn't a lot going on in the car industry, although there were a lot of cars that were coming in. There was a lot of luxury cars because, you know, when you think of, you know, all the movies, you know, Dynasty and, you know, all the shows from the TV shows from the 80s, there's tons of cars in them. And, you know, a lot of us had Porsches on our walls and Ferraris and Lamborghinis and, you know, Camaros. The 80s Camaros were really big. But, you know, there were a lot of innovations in a lot of the other decades, but not so much in the 80s. There was an unfortunate stagnation in the auto industry. And for example, in 82, they were still coming out of the recession from the 70s. There was a high interest rate. And so car sales were not great in the 80s. There were manufacturers like Ford, Chrysler, and GM that were trying to do rebates and incentives. And then Chrysler turned around and said, hey, let's do the 5-year, 50,000 mile warranty on powertrains and external sort of body parts and maintenance to try to lure people. There wasn't a lot of regulation. Matter of fact, there was a lot of rollback of regulation. And there was the big controversy of the airbags and automatic seatbelts on the passenger side. And that, you know, with the Reagan administration, a lot of things were deregulated in the auto industry. So, you know, you don't see a lot of that kind of structural innovation happening around the 80s. What you see is a lot of bling and a lot of different cars. That's when you've got the DeLorean. I think it was fascinating to me to do some reading about John DeLorean and how his company wasn't doing well, but he got arrested on charges of drug trafficking and racketeering. And then at an LA airport was in possession of 59 pounds of cocaine that he was trying to use to save his company. So it's so 80s. I mean, it's like everything about that just screams 80s. And then the first big buyout, Chrysler spent a cool $1.1 billion to acquire AMC. So it just, that screams 80s. And Amanda, you were going to say.
I was just saying that, yes, that sounded very 80s.
Yeah.
The whole cocaine to pay off the company thing.
Bling and cocaine. And now you've described it. That
describes the 80s. Right. Parachute pants, bling and cocaine.
I would counterpoint some of those things, though. There probably was more going on than meets the eye. The hot hatch really flourished in the 80s, probably as a result of what was on the market. People were trying to find some way to make a little excitement out of it. Group B homologation specials were bigger in the 80s than any other time, and those are some of the most exciting cars ever. The Corvette came into the modern era with the 84 model. All kinds of cool things actually were happening. We just don't think about it on the surface.
Right. And honestly, you know, Toyota introduced its two luxury brands in 88 with Lexus and Infiniti, which is, you know, but I want to talk a little bit about some cars that we forget about from the 80s, like the Ford Mercure.
Right.
And that very interesting, had lots of, like, the model was, one model was the XR4TI. And
I remember it very well. Yes.
And the other one I was thinking of was the Dodge Omni, and the Dodge 400. Those were, you know, kind of big. Ford did a lot of things like the EXP. There was a car that was sort of like a Jeep. It was before the Subarus. I'm trying to think of the name of it. And it'll come to me in a second. There was the Rampage.
Oh, yeah.
Which was like a crossover SUV truck. It was very interesting. So you're right, Ben. There were things happening that we maybe not think about that were kind of under the radar.
That Ford Mercure you mentioned, that was an interesting one. It was a very underrated car. It was this is a good example of not letting the marketing people have too much power in your operation, because it's their fault that the thing failed.
Yeah.
You know, they gave it a goofy name that nobody could quite wrap their, you know, head around. They tried to make it sound German because it was. It was made by, you know, Ford's German operation. This is a car that was called the Sierra over in Europe. And it was very competent, good handler, good performer. There were some high performance variants that to this day are pretty sought after in Europe. It was good by all, you know, by all measures. And there was even an attempt to bring the larger, more luxurious Ford Scorpio to the United States. I think they sold about three of them over here. But these were great cars, but the marketing people utterly failed to present them in a way that our market could dig.
Yeah. It's also, that was the time that I was first shopping for my first car. So it was a lot of sticker shock going on as well.
Oh yeah.
Like, you know, if you wanted a convertible, there was a lot of choices, and the more affordable one you thought was the Chrysler LeBaron Town and Country. But then you went to the lot and you're like, I can't afford that. I wanted to buy American, you know, I was really heck bent on buying American. Thus my Ford Probe that I eventually got. However, there just were like the Monte Carlo SS and the Dodge or the Shelby Charger, you know, which they're probably more affordable than some other cars. Yeah. A lot of really cool stuff going on. Oh, the Capri, the Mercury Capri. Again, not in my price range, but.
Well, it's difficult, I think, to make an objective comparison in some regard, too, because being a child of the 80s, there's so much of those, so many of those 80s cars that I really really, you know, was enthused by and inspired by back in those days. And it's difficult to step back and say objectively, okay, that C4, was it Corvette, Ben?
I think so, yeah.
That the C4 Corvette is actually really mediocre compared to some of its other, you know, relatives, but back in those days, you're like, wow, the 84 Corvette, rock on, you know?
Yeah. I remember the car I really wanted was the AMC Eagle.
Oh yeah.
And I love the clearance. You could get it in what looked like a station wagon or a four door or a two door. And I really wanted that two door Eagle. But the price was crazy. Yeah. It was a lot of money, and it was also relatively new, because I think it only had a run from like 80 to 87, and so you weren't going to find many used ones.
Right.
What are your favorite cars of the 80s?
Ben, yeah. If we let Ben go, we'll be here for another day or two.
Yeah, I can't even choose where to begin, but like some of the tops of the list would be like the generation of VW Scirocco that started with the 83 model year. You know, those were just super sexy, and I still think so. And a Porsche 959.
959, yes.
Yeah, one of those homologation specials. And, of course, another homologation special, the Ferrari 288 GTO is, I mean, yeah, I think I would sell some choice body parts for one of those.
Yeah, I also have to say the IROC series from the Camaro.
Those were cool.
Those were very cool. And you almost, it was just synonymous. You're like, oh, you have an IROC Z. Yeah, but you know.
And the first generation MR2.
Exactly. The first Mr. 2.
There were some cool things.
And the long forgotten Datsun 280ZX.
Yeah.
That was definitely a car that I had my eye on a lot.
I have an ex-girlfriend who really wants an 80s era Mercedes sports sedan.
That'd be nice.
She wants it in orange, though. She wants it, you know, and I'm like, I don't think they made an orange one. But
You could always get a good paint job on it. Although,
yeah,
if you're willing to really take it down to the metal. So, I thought I'd bring in some of those, just as those cars, I think, in the 80s, they were also really, really still, rugged and sturdy, you know, the Jeeps, solid metal. Let's remember the Countach and the Testarossa and from the 80s and all of the.
Have the Alpine stereo poster on my bedroom wall.
Did you?
I did.
Wonderful.
Along with many other things.
Of course, you know, fair.
I also had like the center spread ad for a Pontiac out of Car and Driver on my bedroom wall, just because I'd stick whatever car I could find on the wall.
Yeah.
But the Alpine Lamborghini poster was kind of in a place of pride.
I am sure. I am sure. So yeah, the 80s were a fun time for cars and definitely lots of road trips and when I was learning to drive and I learned to drive in Germany. So I'll end on this. That was the hard part. You better have had a fast and just put all of your fears aside and get in a car and just get on the Autobahn. And I was very fortunate to have a lot of car friends that were willing to take VWs and soup them up. And some of the higher end officers over there, their dads had sometimes Porsches and BMWs. So it was a fun time.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely a fun time. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Dawn.
Sure.
And let's go to our next segment, listener viewer mail. I don't actually have a question for us today, but I still have plenty of material to talk about the worst car a friend has ever owned. And you're going to have to reel me in on this one, you guys. I may have read this one before, so correct me here if I have. Becca sent one about her Mercury something. Did I read that one last time?
What happened to it?
Becca says, and I'm trying to quote her here, by leaving in the exclamations and taking out the profanity, she says, ha, 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 this blanking Mercury I bought for like $500 when I was 18. I didn't know anything about cars. And one day when I was driving on campus my freshman year, it started to get really loud. The muffler had fallen out right in front of my dorm.
Oh, no. Yeah, that's new. And it's not surprising. $500. I wonder if it was an 80s car.
He says the year was 2001, so the car was probably a 91 or something like that. And Eric Murphy, our friend Eric, says that his worst car he ever owned was a 1977 VW Rabbit. He says, I bought it from a coworker while in high school. It didn't have any interior from the B pillar back. He had to pay off the inspector just to get the damn thing passing a smog check. This was in California in the late 80s. He says to get it registered, he had to mail something somewhere. And when I was in the post office doing that, the car got robbed. It ran okay until it didn't. It wouldn't start. Come to find out, it had a warped carburetor base. He says, I didn't know crap about fixing cars, and it would have cost more than the $300 I paid for it to get it running again. So I sold it for junk for $100. Was an absolute piece of crap, but I don't learn lessons so well because my wife and I bought the 88 Golf 5 years later.
Well, you know, that really brought a memory to mind because my mom bought a 78 brand new in 78. It was what she replaced the aging BMW 1600 with, you know, that she and my dad had bought in Germany back in the early 70s. And there's a whole great story about that we don't have time for, but she bought a brand new 78 Rabbit. And it was mostly a good car, but there was a serious engine issue that reared its ugly head about 2 years in, where it basically had burned up its exhaust valves and she had to replace the engine. It was out of warranty by then. She couldn't afford an engine, but, you know, she somehow scraped the money together and did it anyway. Then she heard about a class action suit against VW about this problem that many people had had, and she joined the suit and got her money back.
Wow.
Good for her. Yeah, in the late 70s, the four-cylinder VW engine did have some serious issues, but they sorted it out. By the time I bought a brand new Mark IV GTI in 2002, it was an evolved variant of that same engine.
So they sorted out their problems.
Yeah. It may have had something to do with emission controls. I don't recall specifically, but a lot of engine issues in the 70s did.
Right. So we're about to exit the show with the answer to our grand trivia auto question, but I wanted to make an appeal to our listener first that if you have suggestions for guests for our show, if you would like to be a guest, or if you know a local celebrity or someone who we think we should be talking here, talking to on the thing about cars, please point them in our direction. Our Facebook page is currently the most reliable way of getting in touch with us. Or you can email us at thethingaboutcars@gmail.com. We'd love to get your suggestions and your participation. Please come join us on this ride. It's been a lot of fun so far. And while we're at it, please share the podcast with your friends and other car lovers. We, you know, we really appreciate it when you do that. A greater listener count means, what am I trying to say, Don?
I said, a greater listeners mean that we've got more topics to share and we can really get this across the world. So
yes, exactly. We should work a little harder to expand the thing about Cars family and just see if we can have more fun with each other and, you know, get our arms around the world a little bit better in that way. So yeah, please, if you have any suggestions to that end, just email us thethingaboutcars@gmail.com. I guess we should do Grand Trivia Auto, right?
Yeah, let's do this. Yeah,
let's do it. So the biggest actual speeding ticket ever given, was it $2,400,000? Was it $1,000,000? Was it $290,000? Or was it $217,000? You guys have any guesses?
You know, this is a truly trivial question. I mean, it's so funny. You can't apply logic to it. You can't do a Fermi estimation and think in round numbers. You're just going to pick. I'm going to pick the low. I'm going for $217,000.
Amanda, what do you think?
I'm going for the high one.
You're going for $2,400,000?
$2,000,000.
Ben, how about you?
I am too. I think I know the backstory on this, but I'm kind of guessing at the amount, but it sounds familiar.
Right. So this question, I gleaned it from an article or list that was put together by thrilllist.com. The author's name is Will Fulton, and he lists what in 2015, which is the most recent list I could find, what were the 10 most expensive speeding tickets of all time. Number four, in 2004, when Huba Stank inexplicably owned the music charts, 27-year-old Jussi Salonja, the heir to his family's sausage business and one of the richest men in Finland, was making some noise of his own in his country's serene streets. He was slapped with a $217,000 ticket for going 50 in a 25-miles-an-hour zone. Although with annual earnings of over 7 million euro a year, he had the meat money to cover his reckless record. So what's happening in that one is that they gauge your fine based upon your income.
Yeah.
Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So,
and Finland. Okay.
In Finland. Yeah. So the number three was $290,000 for a millionaire speed addict. The story there is that a Swiss millionaire was caught in his Ferrari and he was going 85, which was more than 35, the appointed speed limit in his little village. And because he was a repeat offender and because he made a lot of money, they also adjusted his fine to $290,000. Number two, the second highest one, according to this list, is the $1,000,000 price tag, which is the biggest actual speeding ticket given ever in terms of raw dollars. A Swedish driver and apparent Vin Diesel enthusiast was behind the wheels of a Mercedes-Benz SLR in Switzerland and was caught doing 186. Yeah, and landed a fine of 650,000 euros, which translates to just under a cool million in American dough. And and that's how he got a $1 million fine. But the most expensive one was not actually paid in dollars. The most expensive ticket is the $2.4 million Bugatti that was confiscated where was he? Rotterdam. He was in Rotterdam. And the car belonged to a fellow named Paradin, and and his son took it out for a joyride and thought it was okay to do 100 miles per hour in a Rotterdam 55 mile an hour zone. The laws at that time said that they got to take the car. They got to at least impound the vehicle. And $2.4 million car no longer at home.
Okay, so this is the problem of the wealthy. And although if someone were to be a super speeder in Georgia and get a $200 fine, if you don't have the money, it could feel like $2.4 million.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
So I've got to ask around the table, what's the most expensive ticket you guys have ever gotten?
Oh, goodness.
I'm an angel. I've never gotten a ticket.
Oh, my God.
Mine was $80, which was back in 1988. For driving in my 8-cylinder Dodge van up.
Yeah.
I guess speed limit probably in Pennsylvania at the time was 55, and I might have been going 75. So,
right.
Yeah. $80. But $80 to a college student is $80. I mean, it's a lot of money.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How about you, Ben?
True story.
Do you want to divulge your discretions here?
It's been a while since I've had much of one, but I don't think I've ever had one that was more than probably the mid 200 range. And that was, that would have been an extreme case.
Now I feel like an absolute heel because I've got all you guys beat.
Mm.
And it's been a long time for me too. But my biggest speeding ticket was a $400 expense.
$400, which
I got just after they enacted super speeder laws here in Georgia. And plus he was being nice to me. I was going much, much faster than he wrote me up for. So,
I tend to follow the rules. And it was funny cause I had been in Germany, and so it was the first time I was driving a vehicle in America. And so I will defend myself and say, hey, it didn't even dawn on me that I was going that fast. Cause I was used to going that fast.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I had one in Alabama one time where the trooper actually wrote me down a few miles an hour so that I would not be in reckless category for a variety of reasons. I think mostly because he saw Tuscaloosa on my license, which is where I was a legal resident of at the time. And he said he was my homeboy and he was going to write it down to 79. but of course, I also didn't live in the state at the time. And so coming to tell a judge, the story would have been a real serious pain in the ass. And so I was very, very grateful that he did that.
Oh, yeah.
But if you want to talk about super speeders, I read an anecdote just recently. There was a fellow in the motorcycle club I belonged to who was from Ireland. And he used to just hoon around at great speeds all around Ireland on his motorbikes. And he said that he learned that the speed cameras they used to use there, if you were going more than 178 miles an hour, you'd be out of frame before the thing clicked.
Huh.
Wow.
So that I don't know if he's making this up or not, but.
Well, the Mythbusters did something like that. They even put a jet car on a track in front of one of those cameras using the exact same setup that they put in the remote camera things. And not one single vehicle, except maybe the jet powered car, but not one single vehicle escaped detection.
Keep in mind too, though, that there have been many different makes and models of speed cameras through the ages.
Right.
You know, using various different technologies, and
yeah, that's true.
Well, let's add this to our grind the gear. I was in the HOV lane with passengers in my car going the speed limit, but being pushed, you know, like constantly push. And then these cars keep coming up behind me, flashing their lights and beeping their horn, going around me and it on the connector. And I'm thinking to myself, how come nobody catches them? Like, where are all the cameras when all of these people are just being really dangerous?
Right.
Aggressive driving now. And that's against the law if it's, you know, witnessed in the right place and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, how do you get you can't get the police to be present all the time.
Right.
Get a ticket for following too closely.
That's a miracle.
It was on an interstate highway in Alabama, and I wasn't aware that I was doing it. So it was also near the end of a month, so I have some suspicions about it.
I've only ever seen that on someone else's ticket when they had an accident and the charge was following too closely.
Well, the guy, this just happened literally last week, and the guy was following me and flashing his lights, and I'm in my GL and he's in some little thing that I could pick out of my grill. And I thought to myself, what is going on? Why is he, you know, if he's got an emergency, just go around me. I mean,
right.
But then Chris said he, you know, gave me the universal, you're number one, as he passed me. And I'm thinking, what is your problem? I was literally, you know, just a few miles over the speed limit. It, you know, you're going down the connector. It's traffic bumper to bumper. Luckily, we're all going 55, 57. And this guy is just being a jerk. And I'm going,
clearly he was way more important than you were.
Oh, I guess. But again, I could have, if he would have slowed down, I would have picked him out of my grill. I mean, I could have run right over him. Just good Lord.
All right. Yeah. Thanks, everybody. That's a good episode. Let's wrap this one. This has been The Thing About Cars. Thanking all of our listeners for joining us on this particular ride. Hoping you and yours are all staying safe and healthy out there. If you have any questions or if you have a story about getting a ticket that you would want to share, please email it to us. TheThingAboutCars.com. No,
wait, that's wrong. Gmail.
That's not an email address. At Gmail. No.com. And we look forward to hearing from you. Otherwise, we will see you with another episode in about a week. Take care, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening. This has been The Thing About Cars. We'll see you on the road.